The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Tuesday, April 11th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Breaking news. There is an update to a story that is approximately 3,300 years old. This just in, they discovered a 10th plague. His name is Sean Spicer.
Quote, Hitler didn't even sink to the level of using chemical weapons. What did you mean by that?
I think when you come to sarin gas, he was not using the gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. I mean, there was clearly, I understand your point. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. There was not in the, he brought him into to the Holocaust Center. I understand that. But I'm saying in the way that Assad used them, where he went into towns, dropped them down to innocent into the middle of towns, it was brought to it. So the use of it, I appreciate the clarification there. That was not the intent.
Oi. Just oi. I think the Holocaust Museum motto of never forget might assume facts not in evidence. And that clip we just played, that was his attempt at clarification. So I guess on this day, he dipped twice. So ahistorical. Nonsensical. And can we point out that not only is it wrong and stupid and Hitler comparisons just so lazy, can we also point out that it makes no sense for a White House to assert that a world leader is worse than Hitler if that White House has no plans to do anything about that world leader? At least Neville Chamberlain got a signature. I will note, both USA Today and NBC News, in their coverage of this statement or statements, thought it important to say, I'll read from NBC, the outrage on social media was swift, with reporters and public figures alike pointing out how wrong Spicer's comments were and how they come during the Jewish holiday of Passover. I just got to say that I think it would be just as mind-numbingly asinine on Shavuot or Simchat Torah or the Feast of St. Jerome or Arbor Day or International Talk Like a Pirate Day. Though upon hearing Sean Spicer's latest fumfering foray into alternative facts, I am sure many will be asking this evening, why is this night different from other nights? On the show today, I spiel about the real news. It ain't Hitler not using the gas. But first, are you like me? Do you like monkeys? Are you convinced that there isn't a man, woman, or child alive who doesn't enjoy a delicious beverage? Do you know your cuts of meat and the address to an abandoned tower in New Rochelle? Well, in that case, I give you David Letterman and his biographer. This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Wake the kids, phone the neighbors from the home office in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. It's Letterman, the last giant of late night. Jason Zinnemann, who covers comedy for the New York Times. Maybe we could get into that, but I'm so into his biography, the whole story of Letterman, the phenomenon,
all the shows. Hello, Jason. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
So just how popular was Late Night on NBC?
Well, it all depends on what you compare it to. I mean, the numbers for late night shows today are much lower than they were back then. So it actually looks pretty popular compared to even the, to the 12th, much more popular than the 11:30 shows today. So it made a lot of money because it was it got great ratings for that time slot, and it got the right demo. I mean, that was the word on Letterman, was that it kind of found this new college audience that wasn't watching TV before.
This seems to be also about the time that the invention of the demo, not the invention, but the realization that it's better to reach one 27-year-old than 657-year-olds started to take hold.
A huge shift. I mean, you're absolutely right. And I looked into this, that, you know, if you look at the news accounts, that didn't used to be a story.
Nielsen would tell you the most popular shows. They never broke it out by demo.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And it's still pretty hazy on what, you know, was he really so successful among college students? Or was that a narrative created? It's a little questionable. I mean, I think that Letterman's cultural impact, as popular as he was, his cultural impact was much greater than the number of people. Carson had more people. Letterman, I would argue, mattered more than Carson, but the number of people watching was much less.
Sure. Because I think comedy nerds, and there wasn't that concept either. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy was popular and successful and artistic, but anyone who was a comedy nerd, an aspiring comedy nerd, possibly someone who wouldn't have become a comedy nerd but for Letterman, you could do nothing but respect him. It was sort of amazing what he was doing, in a break from the entire idea of broadcasting trying to be appealing to people, or completely, most people.
Completely. And people, I think, don't realize what a different world it was back then.
Yes.
Not only did you have to respect him, but if you were interested in that stuff, you watched Letterman. Today, there's nothing like that, because there's so many options. At 12:30 at night, you could be on Twitter, you could be watching a million different channels. At 12:30 at night in 1986, if you had an irreverent comic sensibility and were interested in cutting edge things, you were doing one thing, and that was watching David Letterman.
Now, this, your American Dreamer show, it's a big hit for the network. It's on Saturdays.
Saturdays.
Carol Burnett, right?
Yeah, we were just picked up.
Yeah, well, congratulations. Yeah, and you and Carol Kane, who was here a couple of weeks ago, she's terrific, very delightful.
Yes,
nice person.
And, a challenging person to work with.
Really?
And insofar as that she makes the people around her just be better, you know.
Well,
and she challenges you to...
I need some people like that.
I'm sorry. I usually use this ploy to suck the audience in.
Yeah. I'll do the audience sucking around here if you don't mind.
So Robert Urich was a guest, and he's not terrible, but he's just essentially a Hollywood blowhard,
right.
And he'd say things that weren't that funny, but he'd kind of like act out a little, give it a little Groucho Marx-esque sting, and very subtly, Letterman would just dig him, and I think that's what we were desperate for in our culture at the time that Letterman hit.
Yes, I think we're desperate for it now, honestly. Like, I think we've gone to the exact opposite extreme.
Right. We kiss celebrities' asses so much. And the whole definition of being a successful late night TV host is how much you could get the celebrities to play along with you in a clip that goes viral.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I was watching an interview with Letterman just this week from 87 or 88. It was he was on Howard Cosell's show. The way he talked about celebrities, nobody who has a show talks like that anymore.
Right.
He was just he expected them to come and be funny and perform.
Yeah.
And part of it was he got a reputation as being confrontational with celebrities, and he was very funny in doing so.
Yeah.
There was just a deep skepticism towards show business that he had that was unlike anything else on TV, and it's unlike anything else on TV now.
And yet, I think even Letterman would and does exist that he was unfair to some people. He always struck out against sincerity and caringness. So if it was faux sincerity, it was great. But sometimes, like Cher, who's really a sincere person, is like against landmines and stuff, they butted heads because I think Letterman interpreted her version of earnestness as showbiz phoniness, but it really wasn't. So it was a little unfair to her.
Right. No, I think that's a good theory. I think I read in the book about one. He had Billy Idol on.
Yeah.
And he's exactly the kind of guy that Letterman really hated, because Billy Idol is a phony, playing a real punk rock guy, right?
Yeah.
I think Letterman really hated that kind of phoniness. And he would play up the kind of old-fashioned, stodgy Midwestern guy when he was with him. And that was a great contrast because you're watching this thing unfold, and if you had the sound off, you would think one guy has all the leather jacket, the spiky hair. He's the edgy one. And the other guy's got a suit, and he's... But if you listen to it, Letterman comes off as the irreverent rebel, and Billy Idol, I mean, seems ridiculous.
It's a shame that Miss America girl got discriminated against just for being natural.
Billy, I don't know if you've seen these photos, but there's no way in hell you can call this natural.
Would Letterman's show have been so great and groundbreaking if he didn't have the... personal mishigas and self-loathing and just, I think, anhedonia, the inability to experience joy, it would seem.
No. And one thing that I learned through writing this book, and is one of the big ideas for me for this book, is that, so we talked about like the morning show and the early part of the show, but then once you get into the late 80s and the early 90s, the show becomes less about stunts and remotes and big eye conceptual ideas, and it becomes about this repressed, self-loathing, neurotic, hilarious guy revealing himself through these layers of irony. The show becomes, like all great art is, a form to reveal like the deepest parts of your personality. And if you watched his show religiously, like I did as a kid, night after night after night, you started to be able to decode exactly how he was feeling that day. You could get a sense of, you know, what kind of shot he was taking at GE, when he was happy, sad, vulnerable, whatever. It was like a kind of, you know, one-man show. And that's, I think, you know, what makes him not just a great comedian and talk shows, but a brilliant singular artist, is his ability to expose, even despite being this repressed, tightly wound, shy Midwestern guy, his ability to communicate himself over 30 odd years.
It always puzzled me for how great he was and how much you and I and people who like comedy liked him on Late Night. Why would CBS think that that would be the thing that appealed to middle America more than Jay Leno did?
It's a good question. I mean, I think if you go back to that time, Letterman was seen in the press as far superior than Leno.
Sure.
I mean, you know, he was a critical darling. He was this cultural phenomenon. And he was also, you know, seen as a guy who created this whole franchise. And CBS didn't have this tradition of talk show tradition. You know, Leno had success. You could look at it back then and say Leno's success was because of Johnny, because of the tradition of Tonight Show. It was a gamble. There was no question about it. And I mean, that was the great late night war.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I spent a lot of time in the book looking at that period, which is really interesting. The truth is, Letterman also won for the first year and a half.
Yes.
You know, he soundly beat Leno, not just in terms of the ratings, which he did, but also in terms of reviews and in terms of buzz. I mean, the reason that Stephen Colbert is there, Stephen Colbert still has the same name show as Letterman did. Letterman started a tradition on CBS. It could have easily not worked, and they could be a new show there or reruns.
In fact, he won early on. I think Bill Carter's book ends with Letterman winning.
Right. I mean, the question is, and I think you sort of suggest the right answer in your question, is why did he start losing to Leno? And there's all sorts of theories, which I explore in the book. Is it because of the Hugh Grant thing? Is it because of he had bad Oscars? But fundamentally, which I think is what you were suggesting, Leno is a more populist entertainer with a broader appeal.
Yeah.
The argument is just over the long haul of many years. That doesn't make him better. In fact, he's clearly worse. His legacy will be nothing relative to Letterman's legacy. But in terms of just raw numbers, and actually one of the interesting moments of reporting I had is I talked to Warren Littlefield, all right, who was the head of NBC. And one of the things that perplexes me and kind of bugged me about the way people talk about late night, if you look in the press, is the one metric for success once he moved to CBS was ratings.
Yeah.
And
but they both made such tons of money.
They both
for their
made
company.
Tons of money. And
we saw the late night war. It would be a war as if both sides were just prospering exponentially.
Exactly.
That kind of war.
And it's at the end of the day, who cares? Like when you look at it historically, like who cares what the ratings were about? You know, I was like, why did you go with Leno instead of Letterman? And you know, do you regret it? And he's like, well, you know, if you look at the ratings, it made. And he's right. I was like, yeah, but do you agree that Letterman was, you know, more substantial artistically? Yes. So at the end of the day, even if it's lower ratings, isn't it still a mistake, right?
Yeah.
And he see, you know, it's like these guys had trouble even answering that question. And then he actually contacted me the next day, and he made the point that that difference in ratings equals advertising money, which means you can employ people. Which yeah. So there's real financial stakes there.
Which means, you know, also like your NBC suite of shows gets more attention.
Yep.
Maybe he could say Seinfeld wouldn't have been popular. Well, although Seinfeld was a great Letterman guest too. Your interviews with him for the book, what were they like? Did he try to avoid, do the thing where he's funny and deflecting, but not really giving you the meaty information that you wanted? How did you use his interviews to inform the book?
This is a whole saga. I sold this book with the idea that I wouldn't need an interview with Letterman, which was a little bit of self-delusion, perhaps. I talked to his people early on, and they never said no. They never said yes. Or they never said, you know, they never gave me a date. I didn't interview him until I'd done reporting for a year and a half, 2 years, which turned out to work perfectly. Because by the time I interviewed him, I had reported the hell out of his whole life. I knew exactly, you know, what I wanted to ask him. I wasn't on a fishing expedition.
Yeah.
And then when he eventually agreed to interview me, doesn't have a reputation as a particularly great interviewer. I was told I had an hour with him. So I was like, I could talk to this guy for 2 weeks.
And also, what the hell else is he doing?
And, yeah, exactly. And I got to say, he was a spectacular interview. We ended up talking for 4 hours, and I probably could have talked for longer, but I'd ran out of questions because I was preparing for 1 hour. And he didn't dodge anything. He was direct. I think enjoyed the interview more than he would have if it was before the show was over, because he didn't, you know, he had been out of the limelight for 9 months. So we were talking about, you know, his show, and he said as much. He said he enjoyed it. I think also, you know, it was a little bit like a This Is Your Life for him. I mean, I had talked to his, you know, friends from elementary school, and, you know.
So his eyes lit up and he said, how is he? Stuff
yeah,
like that.
A lot of that. Yeah. I mean, people he knew back in LA and people he knew. A lot of that interview was me saying, like, floating various of my pet theories. So that made me feel more confident.
Because he always seems resistant to a psychoanalysis. So maybe your pet theories weren't of that ilk.
Well, but by this point, I had read every single interview ever done on Letterman. So I knew what questions would get a stock answer, and I didn't ask them.
Yeah.
And
what was a question that got a good, interesting answer? A pet theory type question.
I mean, you know, to this point that you brought up about how, you know, he became less adventurous. And, you know, you can imagine him pushing back. And I'm sure there's some people on the show who push back and think that, you know, the book focuses too much on this area. First of all, he had a substantive reason that he thought that, you know, he couldn't beat Leno as a monologue, and that what his strength was in conversation. So he's going to make the show more about that. And two, he said after his heart attack, he didn't want to go to rehearsal anymore. And that, you know, changed the show. The show became more about his spontaneous reactions to things. If you don't go to rehearsal, then certain things are harder to pull off. He talked about that very candidly. The way he talked about the blackmail thing was, I thought he wouldn't answer any of that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that was a real dark period for him. I think I have a quote somewhere in the book about, you know, I think the show was sort of a cathartic thing for him. I think Letterman's default pose is to be humble and blame himself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, when I would bring up the late night wars, he didn't go after Warren Littlefield or whatever. He blamed himself every time. And that's also its own thing to worry about as a reporter. Because if you
can't take him at his word for that necessarily, right?
If you blame
Letterman blames himself, and then it could end there. But that's not actually the whole story.
Exactly.
At all.
Yeah, I mean, if he blames himself for everything, then it can't be true. He was not the slightest bit defensive. I mean, at no point was he. To the extent that he wanted to make something clear, it was that his writers deserve more credit and he deserves less. And I think the book already, I don't think I give Letterman short shrift in the book. And part of the argument of the book is to understand how Letterman evolved, you have to look beyond just Letterman. You have to look not only at who the writers were, and they had many brilliant writers who went on to do The Simpsons, Seinfeld, et cetera, but also the structure of the show, which changed, the production team, et cetera. And that he was completely on board with. But, you know, is that because his reflex is to, you know, give other people credit and not himself? Who knows? But I try to take what he said and also report around it, take what everybody else said, and then try to get as close to the truth as I could.
All right. Wake the kids. Phone the neighbors. Letterman, the last giant of late night, Jason Zinnemann, wrote the book. Thanks. Thanks so much, Jason.
Thank you.
And now the spiel. The governor of Alabama is, well, is Kay Ivey. Alabama's second female governor, by the way. Oklahoma, Alabama currently have female governors. California, New York have never had a female governor. Progressivism, thy name is Andrew or Elliot or Gray. But it is the reason for Kay Ivey's ascendance that caught my attention. Outgoing governor Robert Bentley was a little too outgoing. I mean, amore fu. The heart wants what the heart wants. And the governor's septuagenarian heart lusted after, apparently successfully, one of his top aides, Rebecca Caldwell Mason, a married mother in her mid-40s, a former beauty pageant contestant. Now, what I find interesting about this isn't the stuff that undid the governor. Powerful man is lustful. Adoring assistant accommodates his carnal desires. Oh, yeah, sure. It turns out he's a hypocrite because he's a Christian. Though, how are you going to get elected to high office in Alabama if you're not vocally Christian? And yes, he used state funds. He misappropriated campaign funds. He pled guilty to that. That alone should have been enough to propel him out of office. But all that stuff, that's familiar. That's not the insidious part. In fact, that's not the real story. I want to talk about the real story. The real story is that the aide, Rebecca Mason, though working for the governor, was not a state employee. She was paid by an outside political entity dedicated to the political well-being of Governor Bentley. And one of the consequences of this arrangement was that her communication on behalf of the governor and his political agenda was outside the reach of investigators and public records requests. This is troubling. And if replicated successfully in a non-affair setting, this could be dangerous, a dangerous new tactic in shutting out the public. I think that's the real story. The name of the organization that Rebecca Mason worked for, by the way, was the Alabama Council for Excellent Government, or ACEGOV. ACEGOV, now the ICEDGOV. I guess the Society for Excellent Government, or SEXGOV, was taken. Now, the next story where I want to tell you what the real story is about Wells Fargo. Perhaps you read that the CEO and a top executive of Wells Fargo have to give up a lot of their compensation for the roles they played in the phony account scandal. Remember this? Wells Fargo employees, in order to meet quotas, opened accounts for existing customers, accounts that the customers never knew about, 2 million accounts. In some cases, the victims had to pay fees on the accounts they never knew existed. In other cases, the customers' credit scores might have been adversely affected. So because of this, here's what Wells Fargo did. They refunded the customers for the expenses they incurred. That is nice for them to return the money they essentially stole. And the refunds averaged $25 for fees and expenses, and the company paid a fine. And you probably also heard that the CEO and the top lieutenant had to give back, claw back, a lot of their money. John Stumpf, CEO, had $69 million clawed back from his compensation. Carrie Tolstead had $67 million clawed back. And that was the headline. But that's not the real story. The real story is how much they got to keep. Stumpf got to keep 60% of the $174 million he was to collect from Wells Fargo. That is $104 million. Tolstead retained $67 million of her $125 million pay package. Fortune calculated their holdings in Wells Fargo after the penalties and clawbacks. Tolstead, $52 million. Stumpf, $132 million. My point isn't that these two should be poor or have nothing or go to jail or lose everything for one misdeed, one pretty, pretty bad misdeed. It's that the headline, the real news, the real story should be Wells Fargo executives pay clawed back, enormously wealthy bank executives remain enormously wealthy. And lastly, in the real story, perhaps you saw over the weekend that some guy asked the Wendy's Twitter feed, how many retweets do I need for a year's worth of chicken nuggets? Wendy's answered, 18 million. The guy, a 16-year-old named Carter Wilkinson, is now at a little over 2 million, but he's going to lose. And you know what? He should lose. Let me do the math for you. A year's supply is, I don't know, what would a year's, like 4 nuggets a day? Any more is really unhealthy. Actually, that much is probably unhealthy. They sell nuggets 4 for 99 cents. So a year's supply would cost this guy $365. The real headline should be, man's quest to save $7 a week captivates Twitter. America gives a damn about a task that amounts to mowing your neighbor's lawn every other week. Or teen could babysit for a half hour more, instead puts effort into more than quintupling existing retweet record. Yeah, that retweet of Ellen DeGeneres at the Oscars, that got like 3.5 million retweets. Carter, hold a bake sale. Get a part-time job and quit after a week. Pour your change into a Coinstar machine. Earn it. And internet, defeat Carter. Because the real news here is, if you give a boy a retweet, you give him nuggets for a year. If you deny him a retweet, you save him from high cholesterol for a lifetime. And that's it for today's show. The top 10 GIST staffers / future Trump administration positions. GIST staffers, future Trump administration positions. Number 10, GIST producer Chris Berube. Number 9, Secretary of Everything Jared Kushner. Number 8, GIST producer Mary Wilson. Number 7, interim Moyle Sean Spicer. Number 6, emergency Moyle to Sean Spicer Jared Kushner, which technically falls under Secretary of Everything. Number 5, executive producer of Slate Podcast, Steve Lickteig. Number 4, ambassador to Singapore, KT McFarlane. Number 3, ambassador to Libya, Sebastian Gorka. Number 2, Steve Bannon, ambassador to Syria. And the number 1, GIST staffer / future administration member, it's a tie. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network. An assistant secretary of energy, Bob, the guy who says he once worked in a coal mine. The GIST, if it wasn't a real podcast, it wouldn't do this. Un Peru, dat Peru, du Peru, and thanks for listening.